This fella Ronaldo is a cod.
Arsene Wenger's been in Japan for a year. He doesn't know anything about English football.
I'm so happy, believe me. I'm so happy. Happy New Year.
Con Giovanni, incredible. Dribble, 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 dribble.
We will go away, baby!
It's the history of the Tottenham.
I have nothing to say. I'm so sorry, I have nothing to say.
Following Man City's 2-1 win at PSG on Wednesday night, Gary Lineker declared it one of the best away performances by any English side in a European game. Hello and welcome to the Total Football Podcast. I'm your host, Second Heart, and joining me is Andrew Conway.
Hello.
Andrew, where does the win rank among the great nights?
It's something you can point back to and say, oh yeah, that's great. For Man City, especially, it's a fantastic night, and it's probably going beyond my lifetime to look at as good a European night, going back to the 60s probably for Man City. They were controlling, they were powerful, they never looked in danger once the second half kicked off, and they really just showed their class and the ability of a unit to overcome individual. But in terms of a greatest Champions League performance, it's like, even in the last few years, we've seen better performances from Liverpool in the Champions League in their all-conquering mode. I don't think it's up there with some of the greats of history. It's not up there with Man United against Juventus. It's not up there with Liverpool against Juventus again, just to put them into it, in the Istanbul run in 2005. It's probably not up there. You're definitely not, you know, going back to Gary Lineker's day in terms of playing, and there were finer performances then from both Liverpool and Nottingham Forest, and I don't know it as well, but I presume Aston Villa. But yeah, I think it's definitely hyperbolic from Gary Lineker, and it does probably help that, you know, he works for a station that's currently selling the Champions League and making it sound like this is the best ever in a time where the Champions League is under a bit of attack from a certain European Super League, probably helps all parties that he's related to.
Because BT put up that video before the match. I can't remember if that match was the Real Madrid one against Chelsea. Did you see that one? Where we actually couldn't watch it in Ireland, which was very ironic.
Yeah.
Because it was all like, oh, we're, you know, this is a game for the fans and, you know, giving it back to the people. And it's like, well, actually, this match would have been on free-to-air TV, but for BT coming in and changing up the rights in the UK. You know, the video itself isn't even available in other regions, even though it's not even coverage of a football match. It's just a promo video, which you would think wouldn't be region locked anyway. And BT themselves continuously, anytime there's a big Champions League night, the only thing I ever see get said about BT is how awful their coverage is. So not a great night for and Gary Lineker couldn't even do coverage of one of the games because there was COVID concern, so they had to swap out the whole presenting team.
Why Jake Humphrey was hosting it? I was wondering.
So that was another, it was a weird week for BT.
We'll probably talk about that a bit more in a while, but yeah, just to pull it away from just BT, there's a lot of hypocrisy in terms of coverage, and in some regards it's completely rational. The likes of BT have spent an enormous amount of money on this. They have to make it out to be the best thing it is. They have to conceal the fact that if it wasn't for them, perhaps more people could view this content in terms of Champions League football and more people could enjoy it. But BT have to look after number one, which is themselves. And they do that by putting out these inane videos saying that those tweets as well, saying that this is the best football that's ever been seen. You know, it was good. It was a great performance from Man City's point of view. And as this season has gone by, considering it's been a season of poor performances most of the time, it was good to see someone actually show up and perform well and execute a game plan and Pep not to overthink something, although he still has a second leg to do that as well.
Yeah, and the takeaway that I got from this game was that, like, it just kind of shows the fallacy of trying to read too much into a single game, because, like, Man City did well in the second half. They clearly got control of the game, held the ball a lot, created a decent amount of chances. But their two goals were just really stupid. Like, they scored from Kevin De Bruyne's cross being misjudged by Keylor Navas, and it just goes in at the back post. And then the wall ends up just kind of opening up a gap right where Riyad Mahrez had kicked the ball. You know, not two things you can really account for in a game plan, or they're just kind of two random events that happened, that go in their favor.
Like, and from Man City's point of view, you're absolutely right. I don't disagree with it at all. But from Paris Saint-Germain, you say you can't account for those things. Those are basic fundamentals of football things that you need to get right. You can't let a ball, like, you have to be on your toes to react to that. I think whenever a goal goes in like that, where Kevin De Bruyne's first goal we're talking about here, where it was a long cross through, nobody makes any contact with it and goes straight into the back of the net. The goalkeeper is too comfortable in that position. He thinks someone in his defense is going to get rid of it. And you have to still, you know, act like something is happening and be on it for it. It's always a lapse in concentration from the goalie when those guns go in.
Mm.
Navas didn't cover himself in glory for the second goal either. I know the wall got a lot of criticism and it did look bad enough. Especially, it was like, you know, they were doing so well to withhold real goal-scoring opportunities from Man City PSG, where they were pinned back, definitely, but they were stopping Man City from getting any chances in the box. And then they just give it up like that so easily. Navas didn't cover himself in glory either. He didn't really get across for it quick enough. And, you know, in fairness to Riyad Mahrez for that goal, he did what he had to do. He got it on target and the wall just, you know, parted like the Red Sea. Is that the correct? Not metaphor. Yes. Is that the correct comparison?
Yeah, the Red Sea. But, like, what I mean more is that, like, after big games, I mean, you get a big tactical breakdown. What did one manager do right to turn the game? What did one manager do wrong? The cost in the game. But really, this was just about poor individual mistakes from Keylor Navas and the individuals in the wall. And there was very little else that you could really say about, like, what, you know, because, like, a lot of Man City's exits from the Champions League have been under the narrative of, like, oh, Pep overthought it and he got his tactics wrong or whatever, and then it just goes to show that, like, the one night where things go well for Pep, it just kind of happens from he just gets the luck in this scenario, which, you know, he earned by, you know, I'm not trying to take anything away from Pep, but it also maybe shows that in the other matches he didn't get the luck that went his way, and it just kind of shows how cruel a game football can be and why it being so low scoring is what adds to his entertainment value, is that sometimes you just kind of get lucky, sometimes you get unlucky. And you know, there is something to be said as well about the way Paris Saint-Germain reacted to those two goals, in a way they just kind of
not well. Yeah,
it reminded you of it reminded me anyway of the Battle of the Bridge match where Tottenham lost the league to Chelsea Pochettino, where they just started kicking people and getting nasty with it, and that ultimately led to Trezeguet getting sent off for a pretty rotten challenge.
Yeah, he's very lucky he didn't injure Ilkay Gundogan, especially with the record of that player.
Yeah, definitely. He was very, very lucky there. And it. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, I don't know whether you were going to tackle this point, but I know, you know, it was ugly and they lost their head. And it's not unique to this match either. I've been fortunate or unfortunate, look, if you want to call it, to watch a fair bit of Paris Saint-Germain this season. At different times, they seem to always turn it on when they're going to lose a match or where they're just putting in a really poor performance. And more often than not, they really do, like, if things are going wrong and going against them, they'll either get a player sent off late on because they'll just have acted up or done something stupid. Neymar's done it a couple of times. Or, excuse me, I've almost started coughing on myself. Or they'll just completely collapse and fold into themselves and the game plan will go out the window. Now, that was happening under Thomas Tuchel, and that was one of the reasons I thought that, oh yeah, Tuchel has to go. He's lost the dressing room. But it's continuing under Pochettino, which is a worry, because I think there's some, and not on Neymar is that necessarily, but there is certainly an attitude issue when it comes to this team. And, you know, when things aren't going perfectly for them, which, you know, more often than not in the French League, things do go their way. They get the decisions, they outplay their opponents, they have the better players, they have the better team. But when they're not there and when things aren't going their way, they seem to turn up like this. And it comes across as very spoiled. And I don't really like it, to be honest.
But the thing I was going to say is, like, they are still in this match. Like, it is a very low chance, historically speaking, that you turn around a 2-1 win, but we've seen it in the past. We've seen Pochettino do it in the past. He's the last manager to turn around a home defeat in a Champions League semi-final. He did it against Ajax, of course. Another one we could maybe throw into the great European nights for British clubs as well, which only happened a few years ago for Gary Lineker there. So, you know, like this tie, I think, is still open. Obviously Man City are, I would say, even heavy favourites, but when you have the quality that Paris Saint-Germain do possess, and the fact that they have a better away record as well, like it was earlier in the season, they lost at home to Man United and then they won at Old Trafford. So, you know, I wouldn't put it past PSG to turn this around, although I suppose it heavily depends on the availability of Kylian Mbappe, who missed their game at the weekend. So if he's unavailable, then their odds drastic go down, as they say. So
yeah, I think that's fair. Like PSG didn't offer much in attack. Like they were well drilled and well organized in the first 20 or so minutes, and they got a goal from a set piece just after sustained pressure, and you know that has to be applauded. That was the game plan Pochettino went into, but Man City really had Mbappe, and maybe he was carrying the calf knock from the previous weekend in the league, but he didn't offer much at all in the match. He, at most of the times, Pep had two players on him, either a centre-back or a midfielder, or a centre-back and the right-back, and the occasional time he switched wings. Now, Mbappe did get through a couple of times even then, but never really got to a goal-scoring opportunity. It does make you think that PSG have very little to offer if Mbappe isn't there, or if Mbappe is, you know, kept in their pocket as much as he was in the first leg. Like, PSG have a better away record. They performed extremely well at Bayern Munich, although I personally think they're fortunate to come out of both legs the way they did at the goal line that they came out with. And we'll see whether it's going to get much better for them this week at the Etihad.
And the other British team still in the competition was Chelsea. They also had a pretty decent away result at Real Madrid in the Val de Babas, I think it's called, their training ground that they're playing in.
Alfredo Di Stefano Stadium or something, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know, but they got a 1-1 draw. But it could have been more, right?
Yeah, Timo Werner strikes again, to say the least. And Real Madrid have this knack, like they're still in the tie, and I think, not that they really were looking like they were settling for the draw once they got the equaliser, but it did feel very much like that. That's the way the match was turning. Chelsea are not a team to turn the screw, especially under Tuchel since he took over. They are a team that likes to sit back and like to soak up the pressure and then break with their ferocious attack and maybe grab a goal. I think goal scoring is a problem for Chelsea since Tuchel took over, and it probably was a bit beforehand as well, but certainly against the bigger teams, they've struggled to get a goal, but they got it and they're taking it back to Stamford Bridge. It's going to be a tight stadium, tighter than the Alfredo Di Stefano ground. It's going to probably be a rough enough pitch as well. Like I can imagine Stamford Bridge is going to get a bit of water this week ahead of that match, really kind of slow down the slickness of the Real Madrid team. Not that Chelsea don't have their own, you know, exquisite players as well, but I think it will suit them more to be kind of have a stodgy match and really to frustrate some of the more creative aspects of Real Madrid's team. Defensively, Real Madrid are so as well. They're obviously missing players, but as well as that, they kind of don't have that spine in there that's really leading from the back and really taking a solid hold of that back four. And for that, they can be got at, and with better finishing, Chelsea would already be clear away in this tie.
Yeah, like it was one of those matches that reminded me of when Real Madrid kind of won. I can't remember which Champions League it was. I think it was the one where they beat them in the final, where they just every match something comical would happen in favor of Real Madrid. Karim Benzema, you know, the last minute penalty against Juventus. The what was the name of the goalkeeper, Ulreich for Bayern Munich, was throwing the ball to Karim Benzema, and then obviously in the final, Karius doing the same. So it kind of reminded me of that. It wasn't quite comical in terms of how Benzema scored. Like Benzema took his goal quite well, and Benzema, I think, is actually having one of his best seasons at Real Madrid, even though he's at like the age of 32, 33.
He's taking a lot of responsibility on.
Yeah, and some of that could be the fact that he never plays for France as well. Maybe that's benefiting the lengthening of his career, that he's able to keep going, that he gets those weeks off a few times a year, might be beneficial, it turns out, to not play as many games. So but the comical nature of it was just how Chelsea kept falling apart anytime they had a really good chance. Like Timo Werner had the most obvious one where he just hit it at Thibaut Courtois. And like Courtois himself, actually, like I've quite highly rated Courtois since he's moved to Real Madrid, but he had a bit of a poor game, I thought, especially for the goal. But he didn't have to do too much to save that Timo Werner shot. from about a yard out. And then there was another incident as well, which I thought was quite interesting, where Mason Mount was running forward with the ball to start a counterattack, and Werner was just about to make a move on the inside from the right-hand side. He was going to cut in to open up space for Mount to run wide. And instead, Mount passed the ball to Werner to push him out wide, and then Werner ran with the ball, took a shot on the edge of the box, and it hit the side netting. Mm-hmm. And Werner then turned around to Mount, who ran into the box, clearly looking for a pass back. And Werner turned around to him and was like, "What the hell kind of pass was that?"
Yeah.
But it read to me very much like Mount is like, "I don't want this guy taking a shot. Let's keep him out wide. I'll get in the box. I know I can score a goal." Led to that kind of communication. Definitely worrying that the Chelsea players around. It reminds you of Morata. Chelsea players, Alvaro Morata, when he was there.
It's the history of the Tottenham. We believe in the history.
So moving on then, I suppose, to Sunday, the Manchester United-Liverpool match that did not happen. Was postponed due to several thousand protesters, it looked like, outside Old Trafford, and then they actually got inside onto the pitch at Old Trafford, which was a pretty wild scene, I suppose, as it all unfolded on social media. What did you make of all this?
It's an escalation of, I think, definitely of what we've seen in the past few weeks at smaller gatherings. I know there's ones in Italy, very small ones. There was obviously the Emirates Stadium last Friday was a big enough incident where it was a bit more peaceful, probably about 1,000, and then obviously the Chelsea one earlier in that week as well, that eventually resulted in Chelsea withdrawing from the European Super League. This one was a bit different. It was obviously the biggest match in English football as it's known, the Manchester Liverpool derby, and it was something. It was for a club that's been quite good at kind of maintaining community ties. It's done quite well in COVID times. Obviously, had the NHS banner that went up in Old Trafford, where they were one of the first to do it back last year. They've done well in COVID, and to see, you know, it all be kind of come to nothing at this point because of the way the club has behaved and reacted. And you see a protest, and the protest was effective, you have to say. It garnered immense attention, probably more attention than the match itself was going to get yesterday, considering, you know, the lack of importance of the tie at this point in the season. And it got it called off, and that was something special and something I don't want to say be proud of, but something you can point to and say this was effective in their protest. I don't know if it'll actually result in any substantial change or movement in policy from the Glazers. I think they're happy where they are, similar to most of the other owners. But yeah, it was something to behold, I suppose.
Yeah, like this had been planned for a couple of weeks now, mm-hmm. ever since, I suppose, the announcement that they were breaking away, and this is very much a fallout or further fallout from that initial breakaway announcement that they made Sunday 2 weeks ago. Like, obviously, I don't think this is directly... This isn't Man United fans still protesting the European Super League and that whole thing. Like, this is still... I think it is just the Glazer ownership reaching a boiling point. Like, this is not the first time Manchester United fans have protested the Glazer ownership, though it has been a while.
15 or so years at this point, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while. Like, I think the last time they ever really managed to get anything together was 2010. They did the green and gold scarves again.
Oh, yes.
Which led to David Beckham wearing one when AC Milan played at Old Trafford, which was kind of seen as a big moment for those people who were involved in that, even though it didn't ultimately end up going anywhere. But the fact that it has disrupted the match and the match didn't go ahead, like, I think that is pretty significant, because realistically the point of a protest is to be disruptive. So if that match had gone ahead as planned, it wouldn't have had any effect at all, whereas now, like, we're talking about this instead of we're talking about how someone scored a last minute winner or something, or a refereeing decision probably went one way or the other. So, like, I think in that sense it is pretty significant. Like, you know, because, like, the Chelsea protests, like, they stopped the bus, they delayed that match. Like, I don't think that was what caused Chelsea to pull out, but I think it was pretty significant in kind of, you know, seeing fan action take place. And I think for a lot of people, it did kind of look like Chelsea pulled out because of that, even though, you know, it was probably a multitude of factors. But it was fans putting out their voice in a way that was extremely effective. Then Arsenal fans followed that up. Tottenham fans as well did a protest like last week, I think, as well. I haven't seen anything from Man City or Liverpool, but like, it is significant that the 2 weeks on from the rise and a humiliating collapse of the Super League, like, we are still seeing fallout from it. Like, we are keeping up momentum in making sure that, you know, this isn't forgotten about. You know, the Premier League announced today that they're already, or they've opened up, you know, proceedings on how to sanction these clubs or what to do in the future. New rules to take place for, you know, sanctions for if they pull this off again. You know, there's still talks of bringing the British government involved and trying to do something there as well, and changing the way fan ownership or the way club ownership works in England, or maybe perhaps bringing in the fans in some way. So, like, I think this is again, this is still just a start. Like, I think maybe the fact that this has been disruptive will maybe encourage Man United fans to do it again as well, which would be quite interesting. And, you know, it wouldn't shock me if this is just the beginning of specifically Man United fan protests against the Glazers, because, you know, like, the half-hearted apology video, or it wasn't even a video, it was a statement, I think, from Joel Glazer, was not received well. You know, he talked about rebuilding trust with supporters, and that was immediately responded to with, there was no trust to begin with in the first place, which is not a good starting point for a discussion between the owners and the fans. So I think, like, you know, this is, like, maybe we'll look back on this and it'll just be a moment that happened and nothing really came of it. But maybe we could also look back on it and think this was the beginning of the end for the Glazers, or the beginning of the end of the ownership model that we see in England right now, which is a pretty weird moment in time to be a part of. I know how you feel.
Yeah, I'd like to believe that. I'd like to be on the optimistic side of things, or the more revolutionary side of things that your mindset seems to be on at the moment. I have that cynicism still creeping through my head, and I have the reality of various people. This is related to Arsenal, but there was a mergers and acquisition expert that had dealt with people close to the Cronkies before, and in his opinion, there doesn't seem to be any appetite for any of these foreign-based owners to sell up any of their stakes in these clubs. They've been through worse and they'll live through it. That's their view of it. Like, they've been through franchise turmoil, as they call it in the US, of moving cities. Like, both the Glazers and the Cronkies have a lot of experience in that, and a lot of experience with disgruntled fans and people not liking what they're doing with the club, and they don't care. And I fear that is going to happen again. Like, the only real thing that's going to bring about change here, and this is why the protest in the street was probably correct, is that it endears the people to keep protesting and eventually lead to some kind of policy change. Like, the photo that went around France, I know that it was on one of the French newspapers this morning, was a Man United fan holding out a 50+1 sign to the police as they were being arrested away. And if it somehow leads to some kind of effect like that on the clubs, where the ownership is at least discussed, that maybe that some of the ownership has to be surrendered to the fans, I think that would be a positive impression on things. And I think that might force the likes of the Glazers and the Cronkies, and perhaps even other, you know, want away or absentee owners to perhaps leave the clubs behind and not be milking them for everything they're worth. Manchester United, you know, as far as the Glazers are concerned, it's been a pretty good last 15, 16 years for them. They've taken a lot of money out of the club. They've serviced a lot of debt, and they've grown their portfolio massively and grown their asset massively, without having to do a great deal of investment on their own side. But for Manchester United, they've obviously leaked hundreds of millions of pounds, and they've upset their financial position. They've not been able to compete at times when they could have for international players. There was, you know, a talk about 10 years ago, Ronaldo went to Manchester United. Why weren't Manchester United suddenly going on a massive spending spree and buying in huge stars around the world? Why weren't, you know, younger, exciting players, you know, I'm thinking Marco Reus, Mario Götze, Robert Lewandowski, why were, that's just teams in Germany, but how come none of them were ever linked to Manchester United seriously at the time? And it was because they were seen as a club that was going to absorb that money and use it wisely and use it to the benefit of their stake, their shareholders, which were the Glazers. And I think that's kind of sad for the way football has gone, that it's there to benefit the owners in a way that we haven't seen maybe in 100 years, when you know, and maybe even just 6 years when the maximum wage was abolished. You see it as a business that is primarily for the owners, by the owners, and funded by the people. And like, this could lead to something, but it needs to come from a policy or governmental side of things. I don't think a protest like this and sustained protest like this is going to change the Glazers' mind. I think it can change politicians' mind, and that's where things would start to change.
Yeah, and one of the things that the fans will need on their side if they are to keep this up is the media, because the media can very quickly turn this around on the fans and make them look like the bad guys. And we saw, I think, a bit of that over on Sky.
Yeah, there was a little bit, yeah.
Rob Dawson, you know, is it Rob Dawson, is that his name? He's the Sky Sports News presenter. Or is it Cooper or something like that? I can't remember his name right now, but he made a point on Sky News, not even Sky Sports News, on Sky News, that there was potentially some deadly intent from the Manchester United fans. Like, that's how quickly the media can kind of turn things on the fans and make them seem like the bad guys out there.
Tabloid sensationalism. You know,
Yeah, tabloid sensationalism. Yeah, like, so, like, they need the media on their side. They do have Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher at Sky Sports News, who I think did a good job of covering this, from what I heard, on instead of there being the match coverage, Sky had to do something else. Might as well talk about the protesting, as we're doing now. And then there was also the likes of Graeme Souness, who just didn't seem to understand the conversation at all. He was saying that they're only doing this because Man United haven't been as successful in the last few years and stuff like that, and claiming that it's just jealousy and stuff like this. So, you know, he completely misses the point. But yet he's one of the leading voices on discussing the protests. It's at this moment that when you see something like that, that you realize that, you know, an intelligent broadcaster who actually had the right intentions would bring in someone who knew what they were talking about, basically. Someone like, I think of Andy Mitten here, who's a very prominent voice for Manchester United fans in the media. And, you know, he runs their biggest fan scene. He's on The Athletic. He's on podcasts. He has been on Sky before. He was on Match of the Day 2 last night, I believe, as well. So, like, it's at that moment that they should be looking at bringing in someone like that to discuss these issues, because there's a lot more nuance at play than, you know, someone who just goes, not for me, when he sees a red card challenge. It requires much more intelligence than someone who knows football but doesn't really know football politics or the way that fans feel about their football, especially when Graeme Souness is a title Liverpool, which, you know, is fine, but it's not a Manchester United thing, and this is very much a Manchester United story. He doesn't have that connection there, so obviously he is going to miss the point to a degree. It's at moments like that that you kind of get a bit disappointed in the coverage, and you realize that, like, Sky could sink this as quickly as it starts as well, just because they I've no doubt that Sky were pretty annoyed that they didn't have their marquee fixture to show. So, you know, it suited them to be against the European Super League when it was hurting their pocket, and now it'll suit them to turn around on the fans just as soon as it hurts their pocket again. And it kind of reminds you that Sky were never really the good guys in this conversation. No. They were just a temporary ally. So, you know, it's stuff like that really opens your eyes again and realizes, like, how difficult it is going to be for these fans who are protesting. You know, I commend the guys who are the people out there who are on the streets, who get those signs, that are making their message clear. Like, I think that's needed. Hopefully this spurs on more clubs to do the same, and it'll be interesting to see if more clubs who aren't owned by, or who aren't in the big six, like, would an Everton or an Aston Villa, would they join protests against these owners in solidarity? I think that would be a really interesting move as well for them, and it would really help apply pressure on the government as well, which is, I think, is really right. Like, that's where they need to be going from here on out.
Well, two points, and I'll tackle them in reverse order, I suppose. The fact, or the hope, that fans of opposing teams join together on this, I think it's come at the wrong time of the season. I think, and also because obviously it's the COVID season, I think in more normalized times, there would be United protests. There would be people getting together and unveiling joint banners at matches and things like that. But that's not happening because of COVID. And I think the season's going to end before anything like that could be organized, which is unfortunate. So maybe hopefully at the beginning of next season, if things are a bit more normal and there's fans back in the stadium at a greater number, we might start seeing that again. So hopefully, fingers crossed.
Can I just jump in on that point as well? Like the other interesting thing is that the fact that the stadiums are empty for these matches actually, I think, helps the fans as well, because, you know, if this was before the pandemic, you know, any United season ticket holders that wanted to protest a match, their seats would easily be replaced, such as the demand to get to see a Man United match from just, you know, anyone really. Like they will fill those seats no matter what.
Yeah.
Which kind of really impacts the message that these fans can bring across. And the fact that those matches are in empty stadiums now really helps, I think. And I think it helped that Chelsea-Brighton match, the fact that that match was going ahead with no one inside it and there were thousands of fans outside it giving out and cheering when the news came out that they were pulling away. I think that was significant as well, and that shouldn't be forgotten as well.
Yeah, and it was the same at Arsenal-Everton that Friday, when you could hear at times, because you could hear a pin drop in the stadium during that match. It was a lot less enthusiastic than, say, the Chelsea-Brighton match. And you could hear the fans outside at times during the match before the police broke it up eventually. Yeah, it's a good point, and it's one I hadn't thought of. And I think it is important to note that this is a different time and allows, you know, clubs have lost a lot of their bargaining power in the last year. And the top six have just torpedoed themselves with the rest of their bargaining power with the European Super League. This would be a perfect time for Mike Ashley protests if Newcastle wanted to do it, for instance, because, you know, you can't ignore it now. It is affecting the product on show. If there was another season without fans, I think, you know, subscriber numbers would dwindle, like for the likes of Sky, for the likes of BT and other broadcasters globally, because the product isn't there. It isn't the same. We talked ourselves off air about our own disenchantment with this season as it's gone on, as the football's kind of become more drab. You know, it was kind of like this last summer as well, when the first period of lockdown football, where it was kind of felt, this is really weird. It's training football. They're passing around too much. They're walking with the ball. There's no pressure. There's no stress on any of the players. And it's really become the norm now this season. It'll be interesting to see next season how it turns back, but we need it to turn back to save the game. So it's a very good point to, like, the power has kind of eroded from the owners. They're no longer in the position to say, oh yeah, fine, don't come, because if they don't come, there's a risk to their entire product. Like, people aren't just there to see 22 players kick the ball around for no reason. Like, they're there because of the drama, the ups and downs, the cheers and the boos of the crowd. That's all part of what makes it a spectacle, of what makes it worth watching and worth enjoying the rest of it. Otherwise, you may as well just be watching a game down the park, because the quality, you know, you can see players do a bit different things, but you know, it's less fun. But to roll back on my earlier point then, to talk about Graeme Souness, I think obviously it was a ploy from Sky to discuss the upper ends of the of things, to kind of, you know, make it about the fans, to make it a bit less about the product on show, because they didn't have a product to show. It reminded me of when there's a big news story breaking, but they have no coverage of it and they have no information, and they just have talking heads on screen as if they're going through tomorrow's newspapers. And unfortunately, the talking heads they had available were Graeme Souness and Roy Keane and Micah Richards to a lesser extent, because they ended up talking about what they wanted to talk about and just filling time and filling airtime and in some regards embarrassing themselves. And I'd say, given the opportunity, and I know people have been very critical of the likes of Graeme Souness in the last day, and he didn't cover himself in glory at all, but I'd say if he knew that was going to happen, he would not have been a part of the coverage at all. It's not his forte. He likes talking about football. You talk, bringing him into other stuff, and views come out that may not lead to people liking him very much. And I think that's it's unfortunate for Sky, but they also knew what they were doing when they stayed with that coverage for as long as they did.
I suppose we should move on to I suppose it'll be interesting to see where this goes in the future, but I think we've pretty exhaustively covered that, and we'll talk now about how there's a new Italian champion at last. Inter Milan have officially been crowned Serie A champions for the 19th time, ending Juve's 9-year run. How do you think we'll look back on that 9 years?
like for Juventus, I think it's a you cannot look at it but be positive. Like they transitioned through different managers, they retained the league, they became challengers in Europe again, which I know they haven't gone the extra mile and actually won it, but compared to where they were in 2007, 2008, where they were also Rans, when they were losing to Fulham at home in the Europa League, when they were in Serie B, you know, they've come an awful long way to being back at the top of Italian football. Now, they have an immense advantage in being the richest and most wealthiest and most supported club in Italy. To get them to that point, and the lack of a Berlusconi-type figure supporting the other club, the other main club in Italy, kind of helped Juventus to achieve their goal. But yeah, you can't not be positive for Juventus in the last 10 years. It's been a good time for them as a club. And they've evolved their global brand, if that's something that they wanted to do. And by the European Super League, it's what Agnelli wanted to do.
Yeah, like the interesting thing is, like, over those 9 years, like I wouldn't say it was like Bayern Munich who've gone on a similarly long run. And I don't think there was ever really a time where Bayern Munich looked like they wouldn't win the league title. Like, Juventus had some hard fought battles there, particularly with Napoli and the Inter Milan as well there last season even. And Lazio and even Atalanta to a lesser extent. Roma have come close. Napoli have actually come close with a few different sides. Never Milan. Milan never available. But like they always seem to have, like, sure, there were a few titles among the nine that they kind of ran away with, but there were a few there where they really had to work for it. So the fact that they've just kind of given it up so meekly this year is a real disappointment. Like, they do have a very inexperienced manager in Pirlo. They have an aging side, but you still expect them to be second at least, or at least bring it down to the last couple of games. Like, this is with 4 or 5 games spare. Juve are in a battle to get into the Champions League. It required a Cristiano Ronaldo late couple of goals to get a win past Udinese that they needed to stay inside the top four. They would have been fifth otherwise. So, like, it just shows how quickly a team can kind of fall apart. And maybe we might see that across Europe as well, with some other big teams in some of the other leagues. So it is quite interesting as well. For Inter Milan, like, they've been very good this year. Like, there was that first half of the season where it looked like it was going to be between them and Milan for the title, and then Milan kind of fell apart and Inter kind of kicked into gear and just started winning every game, or winning most games pretty comfortably. So I think that's a testament to Conte, who I suppose we all knew was a very good manager. You know, he did it at Chelsea, did it at Juve, he did it at Italy even, where he brought that really bad Italy squad to a European, to then a penalty shootout of European Championship semi-final. So, you know, we know he's a great manager. He's had his difficulties behind the scenes. You know, last time he won a league title, it fell apart the year after at Chelsea. It'd be interesting to see if that happens again.
Would be my guess. Conte's proven himself.
At which point it would open up for Serie A again.
Like, Conte has proven himself to be the Italian manager. He is the guy now. I think there's no one to question it anymore. He's won leagues in different countries. He's won it with, you know, from a position coming from behind, in the case of both Chelsea and Inter, where he wasn't the favourite. They weren't the favourites. Juventus, you know, they had to overcome that. And they did it, and fair play to him. The squad is quite strong, and he's got a very good starting 11, even though if he has a few, you know, ex-Manchester United players in there for fun. I think AC Milan really did push them this season, which was very unexpected considering they're effectively a Europa League side, and the Europa League squad being led by a 40-year-old up front. They did very well to push them for as long as they did. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens next season, and when the fans return, will that make an impact to the San Siro?
Roma have risen from their ruins! Manolas, the Greek god in Rome!
It was reported this week that BT are looking to sell or partner with someone with their sports broadcasting division. This came out the same week that the Premier League announced their intentions to appeal to the British government to allow them to roll over their pre-existing contracts with BT, Sky and Amazon. What does this all mean for the Premier League?
It means that maybe Ed Woodward wasn't lying when he visited 10 Downing Street to talk to Boris Johnson, and maybe it was about something different to what we all thought it was about. And it was about maybe television deals in the future for Premier League footage. I still think it should go to to answer the second question first. I still think it should go to a bidding process and go through that whole thing again. I think I think it's playing favourites to Sky and BT and Amazon, are they the other partner, to do this without an open and transparent auction as they have done in the past. And I think the competition authority in the UK, unless they are massaged in a way by the government, will strike back at this. Where does it leave BT? They seem to be an organisation that entered into the sports broadcasting realm just to boost their broadband and differentiate their broadband business. And at this point, they think that experiment has run its course, and they're happy to forego the immense cost that is associated with sports broadcasting, both in terms of rights, in terms of putting it on, in terms of maintaining a large staff, which they do, and at high wages, I might add, and then maybe just let somebody else do it, and then they can just chip in and say, okay, you can have this broadcast if you get BT as well, and just make a partnership with Sky or whoever ends up replacing them. I think it's an interesting future in store for whomever comes into the sports broadcasting business in the UK, and it looks likely to be a tech company at this point.
Yeah, like, it's interesting because the last time there was an auction, which I think was about 2019, I think, or 2018 maybe, like they put up 7 packages to be bought individually, with 4 going to Sky, 2 going to BT, and then 1 was left over for ages. No one was willing to buy it, and then eventually Amazon came in with a pretty low offer and they got that 7 package. Maybe it was an 8 package, I can't quite remember. But the point is that it took ages for that last package to get sold. No one was really willing to step in and join this market. Like, you know, I think it was the Financial Times that broke this story. They reported that BT are paying $9 million to show each game that they broadcast, which is quite expensive. Very hard to make that back. And perhaps that is the stumbling block. Like, that, obviously, that's probably why BT want to get out, because it is so expensive. And it shows that, like, if it is that expensive, who's willing to stump up that kind of money? Because you're right, like, BT, it seems like, were in this to sell their broadband packages. Mm. Apparently that it did boost sales of their broadband, but not enough that it was warranted keeping. So that in itself is interesting, that, like, it did actually help, but it didn't help enough. You know, a lot's been said that Amazon are getting into it, not to get people to sign up to their Prime Prime Video service, but to sign up to their Prime service, their actual Amazon website, where you can buy items and whatever. Like, that is very much a similar intention to BT. So, like, Amazon have gone into live sport. They've gone into Premier League live sport. They've shown plenty of matches over the last 18 months or so. They show a lot of tennis. They make a lot of documentaries as well. Like, the Spurs one, All or Nothing, Man City as well. They've done a lot of NFL stuff and that they've made a few sports documentaries. So they are committed to sport, which, you know, is interesting in and of itself. Like, you know, you look outside those big three as well. Like, who else could come in? Google and Facebook, maybe. You're looking at those tech giants, as you mentioned. You know, there's DAZN, I suppose, are involved in sports broadcasting outside of the UK. You know, they might get involved as well. Premier Sports in Ireland. Maybe they expand. I don't know.
Be risky. I think the era of the traditional broadcaster is coming to an end. I think we're all acceptant of that.
There's limited options,
Because we've had BT, we've had ESPN, we've had Setanta before then. We've had other attempts in the 90s to come through, even Sky and British Satellite Broadcasting before they merged with each other, were both competing with each other, and Eurosport and things like that. They've all had goals at this, but none have really managed to nail it on the head, and that's something to be kind of sad about to an extent, in terms of lament what could have been. And then it could have been a much more open market than it is at the moment, which is really just a closed shop between Sky and whatever billion-dollar company can sustain a slight partnership or rivalry with Sky. And BT's time seems to have folded. I think Amazon looked to be the prime favourites, as you said, no pun intended, because they've already done a bit of this investment in rights. They have other sporting events. They have a good presenter base and a good technical staff behind the scenes base now at this point. They've worked with the other broadcasters in Sky and BT in terms of getting their coverage off the ground. And I could see them easily just absorbing BT into their Amazon package. And like in some regards, I would hope that there, for the sake of the sport in the UK, there would be some kind of partnership between whoever gets this and a free-to-air broadcaster, so that matches could be shown, at least Champions League matches, European matches, as we discussed earlier, because they have been absent for such a long time from terrestrial television in the UK now, because of BT and because of what they've done, and Sky prior to that taking some of the rights off ITV. And yeah, you'd hope there'd be some kind of flexibility there. The only concern is that, you know, as you said, Amazon aren't selling TV as their primary business. They're not even selling their Prime Video service as their primary business. They're selling things, and really their product is data, their customers' data. That's what they're selling as their prime business. And that's a bit of concern in terms of privacy, in terms of the future, in terms of the world that we're going to live in. But if we can get over that, then I think they could be the way forward. Google and Facebook are in a similar bat, but they have less experience in this realm. They have the infrastructure in place, but in their video, they have the user base, obviously, there, that none of this will be a problem for them. But they don't have the kind of live, in-person, in-stadium experience, and I think that's where Amazon could benefit from it. But it's whoever comes up with the biggest money at the end of the day. And yeah, it could really be any of them. There's one crowd we didn't mention at all, and that was Apple, and it'd be interesting if they want to get into sports broadcasting for a similar reason, to bolster their product lineup. But yeah, we're really looking at one of these American tech giants to come in and probably do something, because I don't see one coming out of Europe. I know there's other like smaller broadcasters, like you said. I don't think they have the sustainability or scale to do it. BeIN Sports is another one, but I think politically that would be a very hazardous agreement to make by the likes of the Premier League to you know, give all of the rights over to a Qatari company for the national broadcasting, not just the foreign broadcasting. So yeah, I think they'll definitely be pushing towards one of those US tech companies, because they're here to stay, to be fair to them. They don't look like they're going away anytime soon, and it probably would be a long-term partnership and long-term positive relationship for the Premier League. If I were Sky, I would be getting worried. That would be my only thing. I think, you know, knocking out another enemy, another adversary in BT, as they're about to, by the looks of things, they can celebrate that, but really it's the beginning of the end for their platform and their model, because it can't, I don't think they could survive and last up against the behemoth that it would be an Amazon-led or a Facebook or a Google or an Apple, or even if Disney were to re-enter the market through ESPN again, they won't be able to sustain themselves against that.
Yeah, like there's a few interesting things as well. Like obviously there's the fact that they don't want to bring it to an auction like that. That came out first, and then the news about BT came out, which is kind of an awkward timing there, because BT are, you know, if that contract is to roll over and then BT are to walk away from that contract, essentially, like that is that would be quite interesting, because, like, you know, they spend a lot of money on that.
Yeah.
So like whatever, like if they're looking to sell, you know, and it predominantly seems like they want to sell, and then if they can't get a seller, they're willing to partner with someone to work together on showing it on TV. So like if that is the case, if they are looking to sell, like that's going to cost a lot of money to sell that as well, because it's going to have to be paying for the contract as well. So like, because by not auctioning it, it kind of consolidates the amount of money that's in the Premier League, which is coming at a time when a lot, like Serie A, Liga are losing money, as particularly Liga are losing a lot of money on their TV contracts that are being renewed at the moment, because the TV companies can't afford to pay as much money as they were due to the pandemic, essentially. So it's going to take money out of the European game, but it's going to keep it in England, which is, you know, it's smart by the 20 Premier League clubs to consolidate the amount of money they make. And they were boosted as well in the last week by Norwich and Watford being promoted back. It saves them $83 million in parachute payments. So that helps as well. You know, and if Bournemouth win the playoffs, it helps even further. All of that money may end up going to the EFL if they can come to an agreement, which is probably the right way for them to do it. So, you know, it is keeping the money in the English game. If they were to go to an auction, it might not get as much money, because right now they make about $9 billion between domestic and international rights. I think the auction would just be domestic rights, which they make about $4 billion on.
Yeah.
And the last auction that the amount of money they earned on the last auction was it was the same amount, but it was worth less because it was for more games. So they were making less money off each game. So it was already on a downward trend for the first time ever in the Premier League history, which was a significant moment. And this kind of, again, it's important for those clubs to consolidate that money, because if it goes down even more, you know, that would be bad news for a lot of those clubs that are already kind of outspending what they can or stretching themselves to their limits, which, you know, some of those clubs may be. So, like, that would be... That could have been catastrophic. It'll be interesting to see if that does get upheld as well. You know, you're right that the competition lawmakers in the UK might not go for this, even if it might be a one-off.
Mm.
Just because it does set a precedent that in exceptional circumstances they can circumvent the law, essentially.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if they want to set that precedent. You know, it remains to be seen. Maybe that is what Ed Woodward was speeding with
Parsons. Maybe he wasn't lying to us at all.
Yeah,
and he was just trying to circumvent another law that probably is just as bad to be doing bad things to as well.
He was doing nefarious things, but not those nefarious things.
Yeah, it was like, you've got me all wrong.
But
yeah.
the other thing as well is the fact that BT show these matches on TV, whereas Amazon show these matches on their Amazon Prime service, which is very much done online.
Yeah,
and that was, I suppose, the basis of that. That last package that no one bought, it was an online streaming service package. That's Sky and BT. It was designed to bring in a third broadcaster. It technically worked because Amazon did come in and they have been streaming games. They get those midweek games that happen like twice a season, and they get a couple games around Christmas. And it involves every match in the game weeks that they get all being on TV, which up until this season had never happened on TV. With Sky and BT, so like that, it shows that they are kind of willing to change. They are willing to evolve. You know, if Amazon were to absorb BT in this, you know, what would that mean for putting those matches on TV? It would be interesting if they could come to an agreement with the BBC or ITV or Channel 4, who are getting back into sport as well.
Yeah,
with Formula One and the cricket and horse racing as well. Like, it'd be interesting if they could come to an agreement with one of those channels to have them on TV. And then if you want to watch them online, you can get them for Amazon, whatever price Amazon Prime is. So like that could be an interesting future for English football. And it would be an interesting competition for Sky as well, because like that, I think, would be putting it on free to air is really the only way to make Sky have to think about how they compete. Because when it's on Sky or BT, and, you know, someone has to choose between whether they want to pay for one subscription or the other, I think most people generally are safe to go with Sky.
Yeah.
Unless they desperately want to watch the Champions League. And that's kind of what Sky have relied upon while they've competed with BT. So it ending up on free-to-air TV could be a good way to combat Sky as well. And Amazon is cheap enough relative to Sky as well, which would be, I think, welcome competition there too.
Yeah, well, that's one important thing that has to be mentioned, is that if this is Amazon, and we're all, you know, speaking in what ifs and supposedlies, but if this is Amazon that comes through and takes this on and maybe takes BT on, one of the main things and one of the main stumbling blocks that's always foiled competition to Sky is that generally Sky have the good deals wrapped up. They have the good matches taken up. As you said, they got, what was it, 60% or 70% of the matches in the last deal Sky got, four of the packages, was that what you said?
And they get first refusal, so they get to pick the, I think they get second refusal as well, so they get to pick the first two biggest games any game week too, which is pretty big.
Exactly. So Sky get to go in and have all the cards in their deck. They've got the decks loaded, is that what the correct, or the dice loaded? Whatever the correct gambling analogy is. So Sky go into that, and then that's always hamstrung the likes of BT, ESPN, Setanta, other competition in the past, because they go in with a worse lineup, and then they still have to pay this immense amount of money for the rights they do get. So they end up having to pass that on to their customer in additional charges, and then, you know, they ended up losing customers as a result of it. With Amazon, that's not going to happen. Amazon don't care. This is, as you said, this is a side thing for them, and that's one of the things that probably encouraged Premier League to deal with BT originally. And it didn't really work out with that in the end. But Amazon are such a massive company that, you know, a few billion pounds is nothing to them. It's a horrid thing to say, but it is nothing to them. And they can absorb the additional costs straight away and not increase their Prime subscription costs at all, and offer Premier League football with the standard, you know, people just wanting the next day's delivery or whatever they get off Prime shipping as it is. And that is a scary thought for Sky, because they've been increasing their subscriber costs, especially for the likes of pubs, or especially the likes of commercial users for years now, and really taking a lot of money off those customers. And now you're looking at a player coming in who doesn't care about any of that business, doesn't care about pubs. If a pub has a Prime subscription, let them put the matches on the TV. You know, that's how it could work out. I'm not sure if that is how it's going to work out, but definitely for the personal consumers out there, Amazon will not increase the cost of their Prime shipping or their Prime subscription, and Sky will have to keep tabs with the increasing costs of these Premier League rights every time they go up by an astronomical amount. And, you know, as we said before, the marginal rate per Premier League club has gone down in the last deal, but with inflation, you have to expect that deal to go up, and Sky are treading water with that stuff as it is. Like, their subscriber base is eating itself because of the impact of streaming services like Amazon Prime, like Netflix, like every other one that exists. And yeah, it's an important thing to note that this would be the first real test to the price model of Sky, because Amazon are just going to completely undercut them.
We're still fighting for this title, and he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something.
The big Premier League game of the week is going to take place between Manchester City and Chelsea, and Man City could become Premier League champions if they win this game. Is this really just a preview of the Champions League final, though?
It's yet to be seen at time of recording. It could well be. But yeah, I definitely think that this could be where City clinched the league championship. They may not win this match. It depends on how tough their game turns out to be in midweek, and similarly for Chelsea. If it is a case that Chelsea, we discussed this off-air beforehand, but Chelsea need about two of their last four games to be victories for them to secure a top four place, regardless of, you know, how the Champions League finishes out for them. So will they be targeting this match? They don't have to win it. And for that reason, I think that they'll put a lot of effort into the Champions League match and not so much into this league game at the weekend. And that's why I'd have City as favourites, regardless of fact. And even with that, will Manchester United keep up the pace? What's in it for them at this point? They're basically secure in second place. They're not going to close the gap and win the league. So yeah, I think one way or the other, Chelsea or City will be crowned champions this coming weekend.
Yeah, because like if Man City do play before Man United, if Man City win, they it doesn't matter what Man United do. Yeah. But if they do drop points, then Man United could technically still keep it alive. But if they also drop points, then Man City are crown champions. So yeah. City have two chances to win it. You know, it's still four games out. So usually when you're like, you know, Man City probably won the league title. But it is funny that 12 months, they're not quite 12 months on from Chelsea winning the league title for Liverpool by beating Man City. It's funny that Man City could win the league title by beating Chelsea. You know,
swings and roundabouts. I'm sure you know.
I'm sure they don't think about it that much, but just, you know, it fits. It's the Premier League coming full circle in 12 months, which I think is pretty good. And I think you're right that Chelsea, obviously both of these teams will be focused on midweek, where those games are far more important. But it is, I think you're right that Chelsea have every right to focus more on what happens in the Champions League, and they can maybe afford to only have one eye on this Man City game and not maybe have full steam ahead thinking about what they're going to do to stop Man City. And I wouldn't say this is going to be the most exciting Premier League game we've ever seen.
No.
Just, you know,
Olivier Giroud will play this match. Don't you worry.
We might even see Tammy Abraham.
Oh my God.
It's that lack of importance for Chelsea right now, even though top four is more. The fact that they beat West Ham last week,
yeah,
I think just a level of separation there. Obviously, we don't even know how West Ham did today as of recording. So if they don't beat Burnley there, then it's really a chance for Chelsea to rest up against Man City and then think about the Champions League, potentially Champions League final.
Yeah, potentially.
So, or even the games after that, the three remaining games they have in the league after that, if they do get knocked out to Real Madrid. So there's really not much else going on in the league. We were talking about that off air as well. That's pretty much it for the league, I think, and it is the focus on the Champions League. We haven't talked about the Europa League as well, I suppose, and Man United look like they're into the final, but Arsenal, they've got a mountain to climb against Villarreal if they're going to get to the final as well.
Yeah, like the Manchester United match was a bit of a basket case of a match. Roma just collapsed due to injuries and their squad just not having the depth and their whatever curse they have over themselves to do with playing against the English sides, particularly Manchester United, and just really just let themselves down in the second half and made the tie insurmountable for themselves. Now, they did almost come back against Liverpool in that Champions League semi-finals a few years ago, so to, you know, never rule it out entirely, because, you know, maybe a 4-0 victory for for Roma might do it. But yeah, it's looking like Manchester United are going to be in it. I know the Polish authorities have agreed with UEFA that there is going to be a few fans, a few thousand fans allowed into the stadium for that Europa League final later on in May. So that'll be exciting for those who will attend. I don't know, is it just going to be local fans or are they going to allow people to fly over from England, which I'd be a bit concerned about. But yeah, as for the other semi-final, Villarreal against Arsenal, Arsenal were appalling. They really were. They played in a false nine, no strikerless, a strikerless formation with Emile Smith Rowe as the furthest player forward. It did not work. They got outdone at defence multiple times. They're playing a slow defensive midfielder at left back, which isn't working out for them. They'll probably continue to do that into the second leg. And Arsenal have to score goals in this game, and that's something that they haven't been able to do in recent times. Now, Aubameyang is back from malaria. He scored against Newcastle at the weekend. Does that give him hope? Yes. And Unai Emery's own inability to do anything but sit on a lead really has helped Arsenal out. And I think Emery is as much to blame for Arsenal still being in this tie as Arsenal are for being as bad as they were in the first leg. Villarreal would be my favourites to go into that final, and Manchester United to crush Villarreal and win a Europa League would be my prediction at this point. If Arsenal were to do something different, maybe the final could be a lot different, because I think Arteta versus Solskjaer is a much different ball game. But if Arsenal do lose this, I'm not sure how tenable Arteta, his position is at the club, because they're teetering around 10th place. They could finish lower than that if the last four games don't work out in their favour. I think they could go back as far as 12th, which would be one of their lowest finishes in the modern era, certainly in the last 20, 30 years, definitely. Since the early 90s, but I think that season they won two cup competitions and got to European Cup final, or a Cup Winners' Cup final, not a European Cup final. So that kind of made it a bit better for the fans at the time. This has been appalling for Arsenal this season, and I'm not sure if Arteta can survive a disappointing season that doesn't at least get a final out of it, and maybe even Champions League qualifications for those who are looking for it.
Yeah, and just as someone who watched the two Man United Arsenal games this season, I pray to God that Villarreal turn this around or keep this one up, because I don't think I could stomach a Europa League final between Man United and Arsenal, even though in theory it should be fun.
It won't, it won't be.
Seeing the two rivals go against each other, but God, that promises to be an awful match.
Yeah.
That or Roma turn it around in spectacular fashion.
On, Roma would have 4-0 victory and yeah, Roma Arsenal
to play Villarreal in the final.
Or maybe, that could be another one.
That would be funny. You know, it remains to be seen how that'll play out. I suppose we'll discuss it all next week. But until then, thank you for being here, Andrew.
Thank you for having me, Declan.
And we'll be back again next week. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to tell your family and friends about the show. Spread the word of the Total Football Takeover. The show can also be found on podcast services, including Spotify, by searching Total Football Podcast. You can also subscribe to my own Substack at declanhart.substack.com, where I publish two weekly newsletters that will often go further in depth on topics discussed during our shows. Those pieces can also be found on Medium at medium.com/@cheesyheartbun, H-I-R-T-E. You can also follow Andrew on Twitter at Kanban27 and myself at CheesyHeartBun. Most of all, thank you for listening, and we hope to be in your download feed next week too. The more the merrier. That's what we always say.